This is day six of this July 2015 7-day session. And we'll take up a koan today. This is from the Mumonkan, or the Gateless Barrier, collection of koans. It's number 29. It's called Neither the Wind Nor the Flag. And here's how it reads. This is the case. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument about it. One said the flag was moving, the other that the wind was moving. Arguing back and forth, they could come to no agreement. The patriarch said, "It is not the wind that is moving, it is not the flag that is moving, it is your honorable mind that is moving." The two monks were struck with awe. We actually don't have so much information about this. Patriarch refers to the sixth patriarch, Hui Neng. Da Jian Wei Neng. Scholars say that Zen as we know it, both in Japan and in China, is really stamped with the character of Wei Neng. That yes, Bodhidharma is the founder of Zen, but it was still working its way out of the Indian influence until Hui Neng in China gave it the character we know now. So you should think that a master of such enormous prominence, we would have more information about him, but it's just so long ago. His dates are 638 to 713, which some almost 1500 years ago. The main source of information about Hui Neng's life is the Platform Sutra, sometimes called the Platform Classic. Sutra generally, almost invariably, means the words of the Buddha. And this text is dated way long after the Buddha, and sometimes it's called the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch. It's his teaching. So this is a big exception to what sutra usually means. But it is one of the favorite of the sutras in the Zen school for obvious reasons. And turning to Good Old Faithful, Zen's Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson, edited by Andy Ferguson, translated by Andy Ferguson. He says there is scant solid evidence to support the traditional story of Hui Neng's life, but his legend remains a cornerstone of Chinese religious culture. So just to go through it in kind of broad strokes, he said he lost his father at the age of three and was forced, that's by the way, that was the same as Dowen Dogen lost his father or mother, lost his father at the age of three and was forced as a youngster to support his widowed mother by selling firewood. And he is said to have gained kensho as he overheard someone reciting the Diamond Sutra. And He then realized he needed a teacher, so he got word that the fifth ancestor, Daman Hungren, was at a certain mountain monastery, and he went there and was assigned to work in the kitchen. And then months later, the fifth ancestor, fifth patriarch, invited all the monks to write a verse that would display each of their understandings of the Dharma. So the head monk wrote the following verse on a wall: "The body is the tree of wisdom, the mind but a bright mirror. At all times, diligently polish it to remain untainted by dust." So it's a good, solid tribute to the importance of daily practice, and just in order to function more out of this true nature. Wei Nong, who was supposed to be illiterate, got the help of another monk to write his own verse upon the wall. Now, this one is radically different. "The tree of wisdom fundamentally does not exist, nor is there a stand for the mirror. Originally, there is not a single thing. So where would dust alight?" This is a real statement of shunyata, the Buddhist, the core Buddhist understanding, experience of the no-thingness of things, the non-differentiated nature aspect of reality, the absolute. Well, the fifth patriarch, he read both of the verses and he recognized that Hui Nong's was an altogether different understanding of the Dharma, but he was afraid that such a new young monk, he was something like 21 at the time, a new young monk would, if he were given transmission, Dharma transmission, it would create an uproar in the Sangha, among the monks. So he had him leave the monastery. But first, in the middle of the night, secretly, the fifth patriarch transmitted to Wei Nong the robe and the bowl of succession, symbols of mind-to-mind transmission. But then he urged Wei Nong to take off, and the accounts say that he spent, Wei Nong spent 16 years living in obscurity. Some say he found himself with a band of hunters for many years. But during that time, we can be sure that he was doing zazen and refining and deepening his understanding and integrating it into the larger world outside the monastery. Now, the backstory to today's case about the wind and the flag was that a monk by the name of Yin Zong was expounding on the sutras. And one day during his lecture, a storm came up. And he saw the flag flapping in the wind, and he asked his audience, Is the wind moving or is the flag moving? And then, according to one account, it was this incident where Wei Nong made his first public appearance in 16 years and gave his first teaching. Before we go back to the case, just two selections here from Zen's Chinese Heritage teachings by Hui Neng. Here's the first one. In this school of Buddhism, what is it we call sitting in Zen meditation? In performing this practice, no impediments exist. When no thoughts arise with respect to what is external, this is called sitting. When one calmly observes original nature, this is called Zen. So what is sitting meditation? So he's looking at the combination of these two, sitting and Zen, Zen which means meditation. So what is sitting meditation? Detachment from external things is Zen. When internally the mind is composed, this is samadhi. If one clings to external forms, then internally the mind is scattered and confused. If one is unattached to external forms, then internally the mind is composed. Original nature has self-purity and self-composure. It is only when, through causation, some condition is encountered that confusion arises. Remaining apart from form, one remains unperturbed and samadhi is realized. Externally, Zen. Internally, samadhi. Together they are called sitting Zen. Just a couple little points here. If one clings to external forms, then the mind is scattered and confused. This, of course, is why we ask people during Sesshin to keep the eyes down, not for our sake, anyone's, but their own, in order to keep the mind composed. Because, yes, whereas it's theoretically possible to be looking around at others and outside oneself and keep the mind composed, it is much easier to keep the mind composed when the eyes are not looking about. To put a finer point on it, he says if one clings to external forms, yes, we can look around and theoretically not cling to external forms, but almost always there is clinging. So we cut it off right at the source by not looking around. This becomes particularly important now in this last day or so, last day and night of Sesshin, to maintain this kind of self-discipline when there is so much at stake. One careless glance can trigger a thought which then leads to other thoughts, and in no time one can be off somewhere else. When he says remaining apart from form, one remains unperturbed. Of course, there's no way literally to remain apart from form. Form is this whole physical world. But it means non-attached to things, including thoughts. Those are also forms. strictly speaking, when we use the word zazen, the Japanese word zazen, it means in the sitting posture. But more loosely, we often use it to mean just Zen meditation in general, including in movement and activity. Here's the other entry here by Wei Nung. This is right before he died. Today I say goodbye to you. After I die, don't mourn me in the usual manner of the world. If you receive other people's condolences, offerings, and observances, or you wear mourning clothes, then this is not the true school, and you are not my disciples. You should act as though I were still in the world, sitting completely upright, not moving nor resting, without creation or passing away, not going or coming, without positive or negative, not abiding or leaving, but just in solitary peace. This is the great way. After I die, just go on practicing as before, as though I were still here. When I am in the world and you go against my teaching, it is as though my life here as abbot was meaningless. That's throwing down the gauntlet. It's all up to you guys, your responsibility as to whether my life had any meaning. It's a little hard to believe that he really said this. But be that as it may, when he says this, you should act as though I were still in the world, sitting completely upright, not moving nor resting. This does not mean one should never sleep or lie down. He's laying out these same basic dichotomies that we want to be free of: movement and rest, creation and passing away, coming and going, positive and negative, abiding and leaving, so forth. And when he finished saying these words, at the third watch, Wei Nung suddenly died. He had lived to the age of 76. Now then, back to our case, where we have another duality and dichotomy. So the wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument about it. One said the flag was moving, the other that the wind was moving. They must have been looking to argue, because in a way it's silly. It's a silly argument. You could argue it either way. I mean, certainly it can't be denied that the flag is moving. You can see the flag moving. In one sense, it's moving. But it's not moving on its own. It wouldn't be moving were it not for the wind. The one monk could be arguing that the flapping of the flag is just a sign of the wind. That's how the wind reveals itself in form, through the flag or through leaves, branches. There's a issue of agency that it comes up here. When I say agency, it means like a self-initiating action, force that causes action. the flag certainly has no agency. There's the wind. One might think the wind is the agent that's driving, flapping the flag. But even the wind itself is a product of causes and conditions. All of us are products of causes and conditions. And awakening reveals that there is ultimately there is no agency that resides in any of us. We are the effects of previous causes and conditions, primary causes and secondary causes. In this story, this famous story, in this koan, we see also the central Buddhist doctrine of dependent co-arising. That it's anyone would have to say that the flag and the wind co-arise. That the movement emerges out of the joining, the confluence of these two. But these two monks, well, may have been philosophically inclined. They may be very bright, verbally skilled, maybe skilled in debate. And maybe it was a slow day at the monastery, and this is the kind of thing that happens on slow days. Idle chatter, argument, discussion that really is ultimately pointless. Dependent co-arising is just a magnificent concept and reality, that there is nothing. It is very intimately connected to the teaching of shunyata, emptiness, which is also intimately connected to the teaching of oneness. Oneness and emptiness are not exactly the same. That's why there are two different words for them. But consider this. When we're talking about oneness in Buddhism, we're saying that there is no thing that exists apart from every other thing. Interdependence is another word for that. But oneness, interdependence, no thing exists apart from every other thing, which means that there is no thing, nothing, that has any self-substance, self-agency. Everything is just the coming together, the result of causes and conditions. The causes and conditions themselves are the result of causes and conditions. And it goes on all the way back. In teaching, is it the teacher who causes the learning, or is it the student? Well, of course, it's both teacher and student together, and even more exactly, it is that teacher and that student working together at that time. So you can't for the learning that occurs, let's just for a minute make it a school teacher, the learning that occurs, you can't give all the credit to the teacher, and you can't give all the credit to the student. The learning co-arises. This is so elegant, a realization. This is said to be what the Buddha realized under the Bodhi tree. This doctrine of dependent co-arising, and in that is the oneness, the no-thingness, the nothingness, the emptiness, the interdependence. It's all in this doctrine of dependent co-arising. In a sports team, the football team, is it the coach and assistant coaches, or is it the players? You can't separate them. In a partnership, which one is it that's responsible for the success or the failure? In marriage, who is it that's responsible for the divorce or the long, long successful marriage? You can't single out anyone. This is why blame is ultimately so diluted, to assign blame to any one person or thing. Yes, some give more blame than others. It's not always exactly equal. The random crazed young man who goes into a movie theater and kills dozens of people, yes, he's to blame, but he is also the product of causes and conditions that go far, far beyond even his own parenting, his own family. Everything is this marvelously, infinitely complex working together of causes and conditions. It's karma. That's another word for karma, causes and conditions, action and reaction. One said the flag was moving, the other that the wind was moving. There is a long-standing injunction in monastic training not to argue, not to give way to arguments. And this could be something that you could broaden to any people who come together. Arguments breed discord, ill will, and ultimately, what have they really come down to? It's ideas, often with arguments, concepts, beliefs, opinions. Part of the discipline of Zen practice is to not get drawn into arguments unless they have some real consequence to them and something could be done. They make a difference. Political arguments are probably the worst, the most ineffectual. Roshi Kaplow was a pretty feisty guy, and when he was younger, he was a scrapper. He could be called pugnacious. But as he aged, that became refined, and he wouldn't allow himself to get into in arguments. I remember being so moved when he and I was with him somewhere and as his attendant, and there was some disagreement about the facts of the situation. And he said one thing, and I argued, no, it wasn't that way. And then he just dropped it. And later, I found out that he was right. And he knew he was right. But he saw no point in continuing this argument. He just yielded, let it go. Just let it rest. It's not worth it. I'm not sure I'm conveying why this was so moving to me. I don't remember the particulars, but it was just in his bigness, his magnanimity, in not forcing it, not pushing the argument. He didn't have to win. Arguments, of course, go on all the time in marriages. Some marriages, there's more of it, some less, but it's inevitable. And it may come to the point where the couple, or even just one of them, has to choose whether it's more important to be right or to stay together. What's more important, the right, being right, or staying, maintaining, preserving the relationship? When there isn't something serious at stake, it's really an expression, a manifestation of no self, to just let it go. Because half of the time it's just a matter of pride, it's just ego. Who's going to be right? Well, there may have been a lot of that going on here between these two monks, and they may have gotten quite heated in their argument. And then, this, according to one account, this is when the sixth patriarch emerged from... This is how I picture it. He's been in the forest with the hunters for 16 years. They're going at it. They're almost near blows, and he just comes out of the edge of the woods and strides into the middle of it. And the monks, of course, there were all these, surely all these onlookers, all the other no-good monks who had idle, nothing to do, and were just watching this fight. And having been to China, I could this is partly what it's. I'm drawing this image from. They in no time you can have a crowd of Chinese form and 100 people like that. They're all together, especially there's something to see. Now I'm going back 30 years to way back when there were hardly cars in China at that time, 1980, 81, and we would travel in our pilgrimage. We'd go through some very rural areas. And a lot of illiterate people, and of course no TVs or radios, and so anything going on like this would draw quite a few spectators. And this was no doubt a pretty big monastery. And so I even see the sixth patriarch as he approaches this circle of this mob of monks watching these two arguing. Someone catches sight of him. And elbows the other guy, next to him, and they turn, and then before long, all of them turn, and they behold this figure of the sixth patriarch walking forward with such awe-inspiring composure and dignity, and instinctively they part and let him walk into the middle. All right, go with me on this. And then he walks in. The two monks who are arguing stop arguing. They look to him. Okay, here we go. And he says, "It is not the wind that is moving. It is not the flag that is moving. It is your honorable mind that is moving." He may have said it softly, as one in people in authority often can do, speak softly. He may have said it more loudly. The two monks were struck with awe. Not arguing is not only to preserve harmony, but so long as we're taking only one side of any issue, we're missing it. Because the truth always has two sides to it. If you would clearly see the truth, discard opinions pro and con. If these monks were philosophically inclined, then they may have been talking in terms of subject and object. The wind then being the subject and the flag being the object. They may have been talking in terms of subjectivity, objectivity. But on that level, you can't get to the real heart of the matter, as the sixth patriarch did. It is your mind that is moving. Now the commentary, Mumon's commentary. And he starts off quite provocatively saying, "It is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is not the mind that moves." What is his point here? This is an important point in this koan. In the text we were reading from the last 2 days before today, the Zen teaching of Wei Hai on sudden illumination, there is a passage here that I didn't get to that relates to this koan. So I'll just read it. Question: what is the middle way? Answer: it is without middle or extremes. Question: what are the two extremes? Answer: they are that mindedness and this mindedness. Question: what do those terms mean? Answer: being ensnared from without by forms and sounds is that mindedness. Allowing erroneous thoughts to arise within is this mindedness. Being unstained from without by forms is called freedom from that mindedness. Permitting no erroneous thoughts to arise within is called freedom from this mindedness. Such is the meaning of no extremes. And if your minds are without extremes, how can there be a middle? reaching this state is called the middle way, or the true way of the Tathagatas, by which completely awakened ones reach liberation. A sutra says, the void is without middle or extremes. With the Buddhakaya, it is also thus. And then Weihai continues, the voidness of all forms implies mind dwelling upon nothing whatsoever. And the latter implies the void nature of all forms. These are two ways of saying the same thing. So I had to read this several times to understand what the latter was. So he's saying, the voidness of all forms implies mind dwelling upon nothing whatsoever, and mind dwelling upon nothing whatsoever implies the voidness of all forms. This is the doctrine of the unreality of form, also called the doctrine of the non-existence of form. So the monk's mistake, and the common mistake of human beings, is being caught in the differentiation of two forms that are designated by two different words, name and form. Name and form, this is all the sutras talk about how we become deluded through name and form, attachment to name and form. Flag, wind. It is not the mind that moves. There's a koan in the Blue Cliff Record that begins with the master saying, mind is like the function of the iron ox, unmoving. The iron ox was what they called this huge dam in Tang Dynasty, China. The iron ox, unmoving. Mumon continues, how do you see the patriarch? If you understand the matter deeply, you will see that the two monks got gold when they were buying iron. The patriarch could not repress his compassion, and so we have this disgraceful scene. It's one of the wonderful things about the Mumon and a lot of the Zen masters is not letting it get all too important and melodramatic. Or precious. And so we have him saying, this disgraceful scene. This Mr. Big, the sixth patriarch, marching in there and delivering his pronouncement. It's a disgrace. The verse, the wind moves, the flag moves, the mind moves. All miss it and cannot grasp the real thing. Though he knows how to open his mouth, he does not see he was caught by words. Who's the he who was caught by words? Either of the monks, for sure. What about Wei Nung himself? In the depths of our own sitting, we can reach this place that is beyond movement and no movement, where rest and no rest cease to be. Even oneness disappears. we come to see the relativity of these words and how they just sort of neutralize each other ultimately. That within movement there is no movement. There is that which is beyond movement, still, utterly calm, serene. So we don't need to contrive practice Zen only in stillness. We can bring stillness into everything we do when we hold the mind still. And now, this late in Sesshin is when we have our best shot of doing just that. Bring stillness into every move we make. Kinhin, lunch, break periods, walks outdoors, running to Doksan, make it all nothing moving. Make it nothing that is moving. No one that is moving. Time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.